This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The era of white flight may be over. Many big cities that for decades reported dwindling numbers of whites now say that's slowed significantly or even reversed. At the same time, growing numbers of African Americans are leaving those same cities for the suburbs. Last Saturday, a story in the Wall Street Journal described an historic African American church in Washington, D.C. that's now trying to attract whites to survive. A mayoral election in Atlanta expected to feature the first competitive white candidate since the 1980s, and that black flight from San Francisco prompted the creation of the African American Outmigration Task Force. And advisory committee. We'll talk with Mayor Gavin Newsom about that a bit later in the program. The reporter and a demographer will tell us about where this is happening and why, but we also want to know how these changes affect you, about pressures on long-established black businesses and institutions as their customers leave, about new quarrels over culture and class as populations shift. Tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, on the opinion page, a recent college grad tells her generation that they'll never be adults as long as they depend on that parental ATM. But first, the end of white flight. Wall Street Journal staff reporter Connor Daugherty joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks.
And you note in your piece, demographic shifts can take years, even decades, to play out, but that if current trends continue, the populations of Atlanta, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. will be less than 50% black within 10 years. That's almost incomprehensible.
Or people living there would say that, but yeah, it's pretty close to 50% right now, so it actually wouldn't even take that much to turn that back, or, you know, to put it below.
And this is causing, as you suggest, you describe them as quarrels. In some cases, they're outright fights.
They sure are.
Describe some for us.
Well, in a bunch of schools, you'll see schools that have had predominantly minority kids in them for however many decades, and suddenly you'll get sort of more professional, wealthier. And typically whiter. I mean, not all white, but a more predominantly white group will come in. And I talked to a number of schools about this. One was in the story, but a lot of times it sort of sounds funny and cliche or whatever. But you'll have parents where they have a sort of like a more, I don't know, for lack of a better term, touchy-feely approach to education, and they think drilling is bad and this sort of thing. And, it ends up beyond just, different races. I mean, it ends up being with a more professional
Class struggle, too.
Yeah, and sort of a philosophy and all that. Yeah.
Now, the school you describe in Brooklyn, the argument developed over the long tradition there of an ice cream social to raise funds, and the new parents weren't so thrilled about that.
Yeah, a number of the new parents told me that they had a fight, and they were saying they didn't want their kids eating sort of sugary, fatty foods. And then the other parents were like, I don't know, I guess ice cream, right? It's right up there with kittens and, it can't be
pie,
bad,
yeah,
right? Yeah.
Right. And this developed to the point where, dozens of students ended up leaving the school.
About 20.
It's not quite dozens, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, no. You can hear me going back and forth with the education department, right? And basically they ended up leaving. I think that I talked to a lot of other schools that were harder to get into the story, but they, where things kind of turned out bad. This happened to be a particularly bad case where the parents just really didn't feel like, on both sides, that they could. One didn't want to change because they had a school tradition that they wanted to continue with, and not just over ice cream, but over a lot of things. And the others didn't want to be in a school where they didn't have more control over how they could set the curriculum and that sort of thing.
So. Another place you described was in San Francisco in the Fillmore District, traditionally an African-American district where so many blacks have left town that the restaurants and the bookstores that they used to support are now struggling.
Yeah, I spoke to Marcus Books, a a bookstore named after Marcus Garvey, and their motto is books by and about black people everywhere. And the 88-year-old owner told me she's actually losing money, but her husband wanted to open that store, and she feels it's sort of a labor of love to keep it open. Now, they have another great store in Oakland, and that one, I think, does quite well, and they essentially subsidize one with the other. But.
And this is a story. The American population never stays still, yet when people have lived in the same kinds of neighborhoods for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, it feels like forever. It feels like it's theirs. And then all of a sudden, things seem to be changing all around them, the ground being pulled out literally underneath their feet.
Yeah, I mean, that's how a lot of people feel. It's a tough thing, too, because you end up with a lot of sort of, you know, interwoven conflicts. For instance, you know, tons of minority families of all, you know, whatever race or ethnicity they have houses that they bought a long time ago, many of them, and they sell them for great prices. So, you know, if someone comes up to you, to your house you bought, you know, in San Francisco in, you know, 1978 for $65,000 or something like that, and they want to give you $1.5 million for it, you know, a lot of people jump at that. So,
sure, yeah.
I mean, but then their neighbor who maybe didn't get lucky enough, I'm obviously making this up, but, you know, like they might have high rent, you know, and so you see these conflicts playing out all the time where, you know, people feel bad about, you know, on the one hand, one side of it is really angry and the other side is really happy. So even within the community, you'll see a ton of, you know, fight.
Yeah, contradictions. Anyway, let's get some callers in on the conversation. We're talking with Connor Daugherty of the Wall Street Journal about his story that was published on Saturday, The End of White Flight. We're describing some of the conflicts and tensions that has engendered as populations shift. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Gloria joins us on the line. Gloria calling from Sacramento in California.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I enjoy your show.
Thanks.
But my comment is, that isn't gentrification basically designed to do that, to push the poorer families out of the community, to make way for the families who can, you know, can afford it and, you know, who have a higher income?
No, I'm not. Is it designed or is that the effect of gentrification, Connor Daugherty?
I'm asking, isn't that what it's all about?
Well, that depends on who you ask, right? But I would say that you would never find a it would be difficult for you to find a politician who would tell you they designed it that way, but that is often ultimately what happens. Yeah, you're certainly correct about that. But, you know,
you describe in the story empty nesters and young professionals being attracted to the city for any number of reasons. Gas prices. No,
yeah, well, and not only that, a lot of them are, you know, beyond that, a lot of them are staying longer. You know, I mean, there's a certain amount of young professionals that will move into a city no matter what. They've done it forever. But they leave when they have kids, right? And some of them are staying a little longer now.
I just think people who have the means go where the things are most convenient, and the shift is coming back to the city. And that was my comment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call,
Thank
Gloria.
You.
She's also pointing out, I think, that certainly the black middle class is leaving these cities for, well, the same reason the whites left the cities after the end of the Second World War, for a house and a lawn and a good school.
No, that's totally true. One of the things I thought was really interesting with this story, or just seeing what's going on, is that even though there is gentrification and all these things that are you know, create a lot of conflicts, but there's a lot of affordable housing going into a lot of these places. Now, nowhere near as much as some people would like, and certainly the neighborhoods end up pushing out a lot of people. But, you know, if you look at some of these neighborhoods, I mean, it almost seems like there's sort of a kind of a new chapter in the city brewing. I mean, you will see I met a ton of people in Shaw where, you know,
it's a neighborhood here in Washington.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where, you know, you'll have like a guy who lives in a, you know, a group of people who live in a, you know, $700,000 condo or something. And then there's an affordable housing thing across the alley from them. And that person pays, you know, $600 a month or whatever. And there is actually a group, I forget what name it was because I didn't end up putting them in the story, but and there was two of these people, and they were neighbors, and they actually knew each other's situation, that were on some sort of neighborhood betterment, you know, for lack of a better term. So my point is that it seems that this is being done in a different way than the suburbs. Again, maybe not as sort of equitably as people would like, but it definitely seems like this movement is a different, you know, there's more consideration this time around.
Well, joining us now from his office here in Washington, D.C. is William Fry, a demographer at the Brookings Institution, and nice to have you on the program as well.
Good to be with you, Conan.
And give us some idea of the, this seems highly significant. I mean, the white flight, whites leaving the cities, of course, blacks were leaving the cities too, but nowhere near as quickly. Since the end of the Second World, this has been, it seems almost written in stone.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think it's really something that's counterintuitive to a lot of people that, you know, white flight is over. I'm not sure that we can say it that definitively. But when you look at the numbers from the census estimates, sure, the cities that stand out are these highly gentrified cities like San Francisco and Washington, D.C., Boston, and so forth. But if you look at the list of all of the cities over 300,000, even though those eight or nine stand out that are featured in the story, there has been a sort of, I would say, bump down in the level of white-out migration. In other words, when you look at the percentage of the city that's white, it used to go gradually down all the way from 1950, perhaps through 1990, even through 2000. But when you look at 2000 to 2006, practically all of these cities have a drastically lower level of decline in white percentage, and even all of these, some of them have had a bumped up in white percentage due to some white return or to minority movement to the suburbs, as we've been discussing.
And can this be categorized? This is something obviously highly local, and we just have a few seconds left before we get a break, but this seems to be historic.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could say, you know, it really is the end of a trend when you look at the numbers in detail. Now, that's not to say what might happen next decade, but right now it looks like that era is in the past.
We're talking about what may be the end of white flight and tensions now playing out in a lot of big cities. In a few minutes, Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, will join us to tell us what his city is doing in response to those changing demographics. Give us a call and tell us what's happening where you live. Are there new tensions, new quarrels as populations shift? Are old institutions being challenged to find, well, congregants or customers? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, where if trends continue, the proportion of African Americans in this city will fall below 50% in the next few years. For the first time in roughly half a century, based on data from the census, the era of white flight from U.S. cities may be over. We're talking about how these changes affect you, about pressures on long-established businesses and institutions as customers leave, about new quarrels over culture and class as populations change. Tell us your story. Our number, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. There you can also find a link to the article, The End of White Flight, which Connor Daugherty reported in this Saturday's editions of The Wall Street Journal. He's among our guests. Also with us, William Fry, a demographer at the Brookings Institution, and San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom will join us in a few minutes. In the meantime, let's get another caller on the line. This is Charlotte. Charlotte calling us from San Francisco.
Oh, hi. Yes. I just wanted to make a short comment. My first response to this subject matter was, hold on one second, I got a shift, is that I would think it would be a very good sign that the blacks were leaving the city, because it would mean they were did not need to live in a neighborhood that was for protection. They didn't have to band together, and that they could afford to leave and just become more integrated. So that's my comment.
It's an interesting thought. And Connor Daugherty, as you pointed out in the piece, I think all those things that Charlotte is describing are true. Nevertheless, the people who are left behind in San Francisco, you described as not just poor, but very poor.
Yeah, that's what I got all that data from the city. I mean, obviously it comes from the census as well. But the number of social problems that have sort of disproportionately hit the African American community are even like worse now. You know, it's.
I would only point out here that the social problem has been the segregation of the black people, and I think that's being missed. So I'm going to get off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Drive carefully, Charlotte.
All right. I will. Thanks.
I just meant, and I'm sure you'll hear Mayor Newsom speak about this because we talked about it in Hunter's Point together, but, you know, pick your stat, obesity, cancer rate, anything. It falls harder on that population in San Francisco. And I think one of the reasons for that is that, you know, a huge amount of the African American middle class has left and they live in the suburbs now. Mm. And so it's basically people who can afford to, the people who can't really afford to leave. It's a lot of public housing. It's a lot of that. I mean, of course, you get a ton of young professionals who are African American, but they're basically interlopers. You know what I mean? They are sort of to San Francisco as I am to New York. I'm actually from San Francisco.
William Fry, I wanted to ask you about this. This part of it, it's been gradual. Demographics, it doesn't startle you. It's just every once in a while you hit a tipping point.
Yes, I think that's right. Certainly the white flight has been sort of hunkering down for quite a few years now, and the black suburbanization has actually been in our radar for at least a decade or so. But what happens is once we get to a certain stage, many cities are trying to find a niche for that middle-class population to draw them back. Some of them are empty nester whites or retiree whites or just middle-class empty nesters. They wouldn't necessarily need to be white, but a lot of them are. And, of course, young people. And so that's what's starting to reverse the trend with respect to the white population. And as we see in a lot of these very gentrified places, it makes a big difference.
And we've been describing situations in cities when that population changes. What's happening in the suburbs? Are these new developments or are the same kinds of challenges and quarrels breaking out there, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's also the case. I mean, we do have more African Americans moving to the suburbs. Many of them are going to more segregated suburbs rather than to more integrated suburbs, which is a whole ton of literature has shown that there's a preference on the part of many suburban mover blacks to live in a community with other African Americans. But it also means that there are these cultural issues that tend to sort of show up again in the suburbs.
Let's talk with Candace. Candace on the line with us from Wichita in Kansas.
I had kind of a question and a comment. I live in Wichita, Kansas. It's one of the smaller on the end of the American cities over 300,000. And I've noticed that we've had more of an influx of whites into our downtown area, particularly because the city has followed this American model, the new American model for metropolitan, which is let's eliminate all the low-income housing downtown and, move it out of the city to try to make our city look more wealthy, for instance, with, high-end lofts, more expensive housing. So that's kind of the experience we've had here. I don't know if that resonates across the country.
Connor Daugherty, you describe in your story a lot of cities that are going through creation improvements like parks and indeed exchanging, in some cases, public housing for much more expensive housing for people to move into.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. It's happening all over the place. If you think about it, somewhere around I guess Bill could probably tell you exactly the date, but somewhere around the 70s and 80s, cities lost all their industry. And so they were sort of left with these, it's a lot of fun to live in a city now. All the bad things that were there about cities in the 50s or 60s, industry, bad air, truck traffic, trains, whatever, it's all gone. So it's like, they're very nice places to live, and cities have gone in, taken those factories and other other buildings and turned them into retail, residential. I mean, obviously that's a trend that's been going on for a long time, but it seems that that's brought some whites back. And in the meantime, a ton of the minorities have left. Now those two things sort of seem to be opposing. You have higher property values, which either pushes people out or they sell, and then it brings some wealthier people in, and it just so happens that the wealthier people tend to be a higher proportion white.
Candace, thanks for the call. Let's see if we go now to Bridget. Bridget with us. Bridget's calling from Macomb in Michigan.
Yes, I have a couple comments. I am in Macomb, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. And Detroit had a great white flight from the riots. and unfortunately still seems to be very racially segregated. And as you were just saying, they've been trying very hard to develop communities, businesses in downtown, and they don't seem to be doing very well. Of course, we have the automobile industry, which is floundering. Where we are in Macomb Township, our school district is probably gone. I've lived here for 5 years. The schools have probably gone from about 98% Caucasian population to about 85% Caucasian in just 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the people moving in have been African Americans, which is great, and a lot of Indian population moving in. Detroit also has a very high Arab population, as you probably know. And I'm wondering if your guest talks about other ethnicities and the quick demographic changes that have happened in American cities, as we've had a lot of different ethnicities, whether it be Asian, Indian, or a lot of the people that are in the Detroit area,
mm-hmm.
Well, along with Muslim populations.
And William Fry, I'll ask you to address that and throw Latinos into the mix as well.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think this is an element that's been missing from our discussion up till now, because we've been focusing largely on whites and blacks, and most certainly as we have new immigrant minorities coming to the U.S. They first came to what you might call big immigrant magnet cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Miami, and so forth. But now they're spreading out all over the country, and particularly leaving the cities to go to the suburbs, or initially going right to the suburbs when they come to a metropolitan area. And part of the part of the reason we have an increase in the percentage white in a lot of the gateway cities is because those Hispanics who might have first gone to the city 10 years ago are now going to the suburbs, and it makes the city become whiter in a way because of that. Now, in the suburban areas of you might call the industrial part of the country, Detroit, Cleveland, places like that, we are getting a bigger mix of race and ethnic groups, and these are generally slow-growing areas, slow-growing metros, slow-growing cities. So it does cause some challenges in keeping up with these new populations that are trying to integrate into the areas. But I think it's good because it brings population growth to places that otherwise would not be growing nearly as rapidly.
May I ask one more question?
Go ahead, please.
What is the actual demographic growth in the cities now that you were mentioning that? Are cities actually growing in population?
Or
some
are, some
aren't. Changing in the percentage of demographics?
You know, most large cities in the United States are growing. You know, two-thirds of them are growing, but a significant number of them are losing whites but gaining other minorities. This group that we're talking about, these cities which are getting a little bit whiter, are kind of a mini-trend that we just started a sort of look at as a new phenomenon, but it seems to be another way that cities can grow in different parts of the country.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
And Bridget, thanks for making it. Appreciate it. And William Fry, thank you for your time today.
Sure.
William Fry, a demographer for the Brookings Institution, joined us from his office in Washington, D.C. With us now from his office in San Francisco is Mayor Gavin Newsom. And Mayor Newsom, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
And tell me, we've been describing the changes of demographics in San Francisco, particularly the departure of large numbers of African Americans. What kind of a challenge does that represent for a city like San Francisco?
Well, I think the greatness of our city is defined in our composite, remarkable ability for people to live together and advance together across every conceivable difference, regardless of race, religion, ethnicity, and sexual orientation, rich or poor. I mean, that's what makes cities so vibrant and so fundamental to the life of our states and this extraordinary place we call home, our country. And so at its core, a city loses part of its soul when it loses part of its heritage and history. And particularly in the case of San Francisco, we've seen the largest decline since 1970 of African Americans of any big city in America, and it's something we care deeply about and something we want to turn around.
The story that we're talking about that was written by Connor Daugherty in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday describes the Fillmore Jazz Preservation District in the Fillmore District there in San Francisco, yet also an area where businesses that defined an era are now gone or dying.
Yeah, I mean, we were the Harlem of the West Coast of the United States. When back in its heyday, the Fillmore in San Francisco was one of the most vibrant communities anywhere in this country. It was predominantly African American, and so much of the jazz heritage came from that community. We've spent the last 5 years trying to reconcile and right the wrongs of the past and the horrendous realities of redevelopment and urban renewal in the 60s and 70s. And in that context, we've tried to revitalize that Jazz Fillmore district and brought in some predominantly African-American businesses and brought back some remarkable jazz clubs. But at the end of the day, for some, it just seems to ring hollow. It's too symbolic. It's not substantive enough. And as a consequence of that, we've tried to reach down deeper and to understand the context of what's pulling the population away and how we can push to keep people here and retain the numbers of people that we currently have and recruit and make a case for San Francisco's future being a future for all people, regardless of race. And so in that context, we are looking at the fundamental issues of affordability and education and healthcare and the issues of disparities, environmental disparities and income disparities, and trying to get to these root issues in a way that can distinguish the city and distinguish our efforts.
We're talking with Mayor Gavin Newsom of San Francisco, also with us Connor Daugherty, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who wrote The End of White Flight, the piece we're writing about in Saturday's editions of the newspaper. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mayor Newsom, a caller earlier suggested the idea that, well, to some degree, if African Americans can get wealthy enough to move out of the city to a nice suburb outside, well, it may not be good for San Francisco, but might be good for them.
Yeah, no, and I mean, we don't begrudge anyone leaving our city. We're a very transient city, that is true, but we're also a city that is growing. And to William's point, we're one of those two-thirds of American cities that are growing quite substantially. We just challenged our Census Bureau data, suggesting we have 100,000 more people than the Census Bureau announced recently. And we're seeing huge numbers of newcomers into our city, but we're not seeing those numbers increase for African Americans. And again, I want a city that is representative of the state. I want a city that's representative of this country. And I think it's important to reconcile that and to look at the underlying causes. I mean, 4 out of 5 toxic waste dumps in America are in predominantly African American communities. We have concentrations of poverty in cities like San Francisco that are disgraceful. And so we've got to start to address those fundamentals by rebuilding public housing, rebuilding communities and people's lives, and deal with asset creation, not just income, and begin to focus on environmental injustice. And one of the areas that you'll be hearing a lot about, and you're hearing a lot about it now, but I think it's going to ratchet up, is the extraordinary opportunities that we have in front of us to lock those that have been locked out of the industrial economy and make sure they're locked into this new green economy, workforce training jobs, and creating the jobs of the future with these alternative fuel technologies. And I think you're hearing a lot of cities that are addressing economic development and the issues of social inequality and environmental injustice in ways that also address the larger issue of climate change as also a key strategy to begin to turn the tide.
Well, let's see if we get another caller in on this conversation. Diane, Diane's with us from St. Paul in Minnesota.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I see the exact same trend happening in St. Paul, Minnesota. I live in the Dayton Bluff area, St. Paul. I'm across the Mississippi River from the downtown area of St. Paul. This weekend I went to the farmer's market in downtown St. Paul, and we have a lot of Hmong and Caucasian vendors, and the buyers are mostly Caucasian.
And that's a change?
From what I've seen, yes, definitely. A lot of upper-scale condos going in. Like I said, the business, the revitalization of downtown St. Paul, a lot of white faces.
Hmm. And I guess Mayor Newsom, she's describing change, which on one face of it is very positive, and I'm sure the same thing happens in San Francisco. Property values there are among the highest in the nation,
yeah,
among the highest in the world. The fact of the matter is that does not come without a price.
Yeah, Neil, that's the great challenge, and it really is a challenge, and there's no soundbite on this, but it's the whole fundamental of gentrification. You make a substantial investment in a community, and as a consequence of that investment that people seem to enjoy, people are priced out or take advantage of the increased prices. And as you said just a moment ago, people then sell their home for a profit and then take the opportunity to move to the suburbs or the exurbs and buy a larger home. And so it is very, very complex. It is creating opportunities and making investments at the same time, maintaining the status of those that don't want to move or feel that they're being pushed out. And, you know, that's why we are fundamentally in San Francisco, we try to address these things in multiple fashions. With the highest minimum wage outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, in America. We have universal preschool in our city, targeted disproportionately African American and Latino community. We're doing universal health care. I mean, this is one of the great stories of any American city. Over a third of our population has now got universal health access that was previously locked out just a year ago.
And Mayor Newsom, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're
help advance this effort substantially.
Thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Connor Daugherty, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, who wrote the article we based this program on. Thanks for the piece. Nice job.
Thank you.
He joined us from our bureau in New York. Up next, 20-somethings getting by in the big city. When is it time to cut the purse strings from mom and dad? Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So, you've recently graduated college, got that first job in the big city, and now face real-world financial difficulties. Rent, utilities, college loans, clothes, maybe a night out for dinner, and savings. All right, forget about savings. You're barely making ends meet as it is. Unless you access the genetic ATM, mom and dad. In an opinion piece in Newsweek magazine, Melody Serafino argues that the price of that parental assistance is too high to be fully adult, she writes, to her generation, requires financial independence, even if that means sacrifices. Well, we want to hear from you 20-somethings. Do you still get financial support from your folks and parents? Do you still subsidize your kids? When is the right time to cut the parental purse strings? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Melody Serafino joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you in the program today.
Thanks, Neil. It's good to be here.
Oh, good. And so this is an opinion you seem to think is, not held widely in your age group.
The opinion that being under your parents' financial is that something that you think people...
No, you're feeling that to be adult means financially independent.
That's exactly. I mean, growing up for me, what really signified adulthood was being able to cut the purse strings, be on your own, pay your own rent. And there's, you know, a certain credibility that comes with that, a certain responsibility, of course, and just a feeling of liberation.
A feeling of liberation.
Absolutely. You know, you no longer have to answer to your parents when you don't have to ask them for money.
So
you can make your own decisions.
So if you wanted to move to the Lower East Side and your parents object, so what?
So what? It's your money. What can they really say?
And the other part of that equation, though, is that you describe a lot of people in your generation, a lot of your friends, who do accept money and with it the shopping sprees that you may not have a chance to do.
That's true. But I think everyone can manage to make it work in New York. And yes, maybe you have to cut back on some of the superfluous spending, as I'll call it, in order to sort of scrape by. But isn't there something that comes from that, some feeling of being on your own that is much more rewarding?
There's a discussion going on at Newsweek's website about your column, and a lot of people seem pretty annoyed with you.
I noticed that, but you know what? That's great. I love the reaction. It means people are actually being moved by it.
Nevertheless, you also took advantage of some familial help. You were in a relative's apartment in Tribeca for 3 months when you first got to New York 3 years ago, and, that's kind of a handout.
Yes. Well, what happened is I actually got my job about 4 days before I graduated, had to start immediately 2 weeks later, didn't have a chance to find an apartment, and my uncle offered his place for that three-month period, and that's when I saved my money so that the minute I moved out, I was on my own.
And so you had a bank account, something you could fall back on, and some fluidity, some liquidity, if you will.
Absolutely.
You've also said that you do understand that in a real crisis, your parents are there to back you up.
Yes. I mean, that's something they said to me when I moved to New York. They said, listen, if it ever comes to a point where you need help and it's a crisis, you know you can come to us. And I said, well, I hope to never let it get to that point. I really want to make this work on my own. And that was 3 years ago, and I haven't gone to them since.
And the source of that decision, you say?
I think it's just the way my parents brought me up. They always brought me up to really budget my money, be conscious about it. I've been saving since I was really young, and now I have that savings to draw on should some sort of crisis come up.
We'd like to get some listeners involved in this conversation, whether you're going to applaud Melody Serafino for her stance that financial independence is the only true sign of adulthood, or if you want to denounce her, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We also want to hear from those of you who are, 20-somethings, if you will, and from their parents as well. Let's even get Jay on the line, and Jay's with us from Chesapeake in Virginia.
Thank you for taking my call, and I applaud the young lady. The first thing I thought of when you had this topic was the movie about Joan Crawford starring Faye Dunaway, where she did not give Christina one single dime. And believe it or not, Christina was better off for it. And I personally do not have any children, in full disclosure. However, I do live with two gentlemen that, like myself, are single and with no children. But these two gentlemen are constantly asking their parents for this, that, and the other. And I told them, I says, you know, one day, you know, your parents are not going to be there. You're not going to be in a position to take care of yourself. And for those of us that are your friends, we're going to be replacing your parents as far as giving you advice, telling you what to do, and being your safety net. The sooner you learn to fly without a safety net, the better you are. These parents that are doing this to their kids, providing for them, they're just crippling them for life. I listen on the radio.
Well, I was just going to point out, Jay, that in my experience, friends, though they mean very well, are a much less reliable safety net than your parents.
Well, the point that I'm trying to make is that the way that I was raised was I heard, when you're 18, you're out the door. Don't ask us for nothing. And I believe that my parents, even though they might not have been preparing me for the future with those words of advice, they did me a great favor. I have learned to do without the things that I would normally be asking other people to help me with. You just learn to either do it for yourself or you do without those things. And I think you're a better person if you're self-reliant. I just do.
All right, Jay. Thanks very much for the call. And Melody, you're not going to find an argument there.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that's the real problem, is that if your parents are constantly providing for you, when the day comes that for some reason they can't, you're left high and dry and you don't know what to do. And I've seen this problem with my friends where, you know, their parents have cut the purse strings finally 3 years after college, and now they can't afford their rent because they've never budgeted for their rent, and they have to move and they can't live the lifestyle that they've been living the last 3 years.
And that gets progressively more difficult the longer this. Well, I think a lot of people have called it extended adolescence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't think it's the only key to being an adult. But for me, certainly, that was one of the main responsibilities of being adult, is financial responsibility.
Let's see if we get Sarah on the line. And Sarah's calling us from Des Moines, Iowa.
Hi. I realized that I needed to stop taking money from my parents when I realized that my parents needed to retire soon. I was about 24 years old, and they said, we could pay off your student loans, but we need to retire. So, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks, Sarah. And obviously something, everybody's in a different financial situation, but the financial situation your parents are in is something that their kids should take into account.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in this economy today, we couldn't ask for a better time to learn how to budget money. So why not start now?
The sacrifices that are involved, all right. There's not all that many people, I don't think, who take mom and dad's money and go for a spree at Gucci. But you do describe...
But you'd be surprised.
Well, I might be. But you do describe a friend who said, you know, it would mean the difference between living in Manhattan, which is very expensive, or moving to Brooklyn or Queens, considerably less fashionable, a long ride in the subway if you want to get to work.
Right. And there are some people that just aren't willing to make that sacrifice. And that's fine. If you want to stay in Manhattan, find a way to make it work. I mean, I'm not telling you need to move out of Manhattan, but certainly if you want a certain lifestyle, you should try to achieve it on your own.
Let's get Amber on the line. Amber with us from Monroe in Michigan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I'm calling because my sister and I have opposite experiences. I put myself through college with scholarships and whatnot, and my parents completely subsidized her life through college, and it worked out great. I mean, we're both adults, and we both have our own lives now, but it worked out okay for both of us. So I'm not sure that it's a terrible thing. And I'm 29 and she's 24.
I was going to say that you seem to be the older one.
I am.
And there had to have been a moment, maybe just a fleeting moment, of resentment over the difference in the way these two situations played out.
Mostly for me, it was interesting. I have two children, and I was much busier raising my children and trying to maintain my scholarships than to be irritated with my sister, because I needed her to lean on for support.
Well, I wasn't talking about being irritated with your sister so much as your parents.
I'm not sure that it wouldn't have gotten me anywhere. So, and then my sister would not have been as successful as she is. So it just would have brought things down instead of... It would have been a waste of energy on my part.
So no one has suffered on this?
I don't think so. I really don't.
Well, interesting. A win-win situation. Thanks for the call, Amber.
That's interesting. I wonder if that was a choice for her to put herself through or how that all worked out.
Uh-huh. Well, it also may have been a financial. I should have kept her on the line and asked her. I apologize for that. Anyway, let's get Rob on the line. Rob's calling us from Miami.
Hi. I'm just calling because I'm a 24-year-old student, you know, post-college student, and I have student loans to pay off. And in today's society, you know, 30 is the new 20. We're not living in a society today where most people think of 18, you're out the door, it's over. You know, college is $50,000+ a year if you go to a private school. That's a huge burden of responsibility to put on somebody when they graduate college to have to be paying off those loans, you know, $500, sometimes $1,000 a month, you know, if you didn't finance it right, which a lot of people who take out student loans without the help of their parents have to do. And, you know, if the parents want to help out, I think it's the parents' choice. And then you write columns such as this that, you know, somebody's parents might read, and then they get all worried that they're doing the wrong thing for their child, and all of a sudden, you know, they get cut off because they start second-guessing their decision, and then the child's left, you know, high and dry.
There's that annoyance we were looking for.
That's okay. I understand where you're coming from. I think student loans, I think, are separate from paying someone's rent, paying someone's utilities, giving them extra money on the side. The way I've always thought and the way I've been brought up is that, you know, parents are there, if they can, to help put you through school. And I understand that that's a huge burden. But then there are other places you can make sacrifices so that you're able to pay off as much as you can every month. I don't know that I agree with the 30 is the new 20 in the sense that if we keep saying things like that, then, you know, then 40 will become the new 20. And then when are we ever taking responsibility for ourselves?
I mean, the average age of marriage today is, I believe, 32 years old. Before, it was 19 years old. Obviously, the generation gap has changed, and the way we're raised is differently. You know, you have these, you call them, I guess, helicopter hover parents.
Mm-hmm.
But what's wrong with the help of a parent if they're willing to provide it? I'm not saying that they should pay every bill that you have, but if they want to throw you, you know, half your month's rent and help you build a savings because they can, what's wrong with the fact that when I hit 30, I'm going to have a savings thanks to my parents, and I'm going to be able to back off of them when I'm ready to back off of them?
But that's the question. Will you be able to?
Course,
I mean, that's where I foresee the problem is, you know, when you get to that age, is it that easy to just say, well, I've gotten support for you for the last 30 years, and now I'm on my own, and I'm 100% willing to be on my own?
Well, I think that most people at some point break off from the parents, but I think that, you know, that's a decision between the parent and the child. And when you write columns like this, it screws up the mental thoughts of a parent.
Well, listen, everyone can parent how they want to parent. I'm not here to tell them how. I'm just, you know, making commentary based on my experience with friends.
I commend you. I commend you for going to New York and living on your own. I think that's a great thing.
All right.
But, you know, I think that just you have to take in consideration other people's, you know.
Absolutely.
Rob, good luck with the student loans.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. We're talking with Melody Serafina, who wrote an article in this week's issue of Newsweek magazine about college graduates who are supported financially by their parents. True adulthood, she said, begins with financial independence. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Jameson. Jameson with us from Salem in Oregon.
Hi. I like what I hear. I am a parent of 5 kids. My oldest is almost 17, and I count it as my great responsibility to train them to be adults, to train them to be independent of me. I am very involved in their lives. We homeschool. They work for me. You know, not all of them yet, but I mean, this is the vision that we're promoting, is we're not cutting them loose now. To let the world guide them or media culture guide them or the public schools to guide them. We're wanting to train them not to extend their childhood or adolescence into their 30s, but to train them to be responsible adults so that when they graduate from high school, then they can negotiate some issues here. Do they want more education? Do they want to help us pay rent? Do they just want to work more? Do they want to do mission work and we're going to help support that? Either way, we expect them to be responsible adults when they graduate from high school.
All right. Jameson, thanks for the call. I think you're driving, so be careful out there, okay?
I am. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the phone call. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Philip. Philip with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
How you doing today, sir?
All right.
You know, I think your parents or whoever can kind of step in and help you if they feel that that's the correct thing is the right thing to do. And, you know, I fell on my face in my first career, and I had to redirect. And, you know, I ended up moving back into the house twice. And, you know, from that point, I lifted myself out and became a senior vice president of a large financial institution. But if my parents weren't there to help me, I was in two situations where I was going to end up on the street.
I'm not sure that that's what Melody was talking about, not the situation where, as you say, you fell flat on your face and needed to move back into your home, but the situation where you're out on your own and you know, a lifestyle you probably couldn't otherwise afford is subsidized by your parents.
Yeah, right. I think yours is...
Go ahead, please.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I think yours is sort of an extreme situation where maybe at that point in your life that's who you had to turn to, and I don't see a problem with that necessarily. What I see a problem with is kids who, or young people who can be on their own and can afford to be on their own and are perfectly capable of making those decisions and, you know, are in a circumstance where they're able to make those decisions on their own and yet are still going back to their parents for every little financial need.
Yeah, well, they shouldn't be doing that at all. But, you know, and they had to decide the second time if, you know, they were going to allow me to come back or, here, I'm kind of in limbo. It's like, I've got no money in the bank. I've got no credit. I've got nowhere to go. And finally they kind of said, okay, come on back. And yeah, I restarted my career and redirected. And like I said, I'm a millionaire now.
I hope some of that money has gone back to your parents.
Well, I do contribute to NPR.
Oh, well, good.
And I do help take care of my mother.
All right, Philip. Thanks very much for the phone call and appreciate it. And if let's hope that was the last time you have to move back in.
Oh, thank you very well now. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. And Melody Serafino, we appreciate your time today, too.
Thank you so much.
Melody Serafino's column, Subsidized in the City, appears in this week's issue of Newsweek magazine. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the benefits and the risks of prisoner swaps, that following Israel's exchange last week of 5 Lebanese prisoners in exchange for the bodies of 2 Israeli soldiers. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.